Welcome to History Lost in Time, from one enthusiast to others.
And welcome to episode 16. In this aerospace episode, I will not talk about another close support aircraft for a change, but about the Focke-Wulf 200. How shall I introduce this aircraft? As a civilian airliner, a maritime patrol aircraft, a long-range bomber, or a transporter? Because she was used in all these roles.
Why this topic today?
I assume that the Focke-Wulf 200 is much more known in Great Britain than elsewhere. For Germany, it was one aircraft among many. But for Britain, it was a rather special aircraft during World War II. I'll explain to you why in this episode. In any case, the history of the Focke-Wulf 200 is a fascinating one.
Political background and commentary.
No agenda. The only statement which I'd like to make is that I support the idea of having an independent naval air force. The history of the Focke-Wulf 200 clearly shows why I consider that to be a good thing.
The sources.
Three books plus Wikipedia were my sources for this episode. Caius Becker, Verdammte See, ein Kriegstagebuch der deutschen Marine. Translation, Damned Sea, a wartime diary of the German Navy. Published by Gerhard Stalling Verlag, Oldenburg, 1971. Becker wrote several books about World War II. Karl Dönitz, 10 Jahre und 20 Tage, Erinnerungen 1935 bis 45. Translation, 10 Years and 20 Days, Memories 1935 to 45. Published by Verlag Bernhard und Gräfe, Bonn, 2015. Karl Dönitz was Commander-in-Chief of the submarines at the beginning of the war and later head of the entire Navy. He was also the last Reichspräsident of the German Empire. Eric Brown, Berühmte Flugzeuge der Luftwaffe, 1939 bis 45, Berichte eines Testpiloten. Translation, Famous Aircraft of the Luftwaffe, 1939 to 1945, Reports of a Test Pilot. Published by Motorbuchverlag Stuttgart, 2011. Originally published as Wings of the Luftwaffe, MacDonald & James Publishing Limited, London, 1977. Eric Brown is a British test pilot that probably flew more different types of aircraft than anyone else. Next to Allied aircraft, he also flew most Axis aircraft. So when he makes a judgment call about an aircraft, one should listen. Originally, I wanted to use another book as a source. I vividly remember reading about the Atlantic missions of the Focke-Wulf 200 in this book, but despite my best efforts, I can't for the love of me remember which book that was. It's definitely not one that I own at the moment. I only remember that it was an older book. Luckily, I was able to gather all the required information from other books. However, it is a bit sad, because that means that less first-hand information will be part of this episode. Originally, the Focke-Wulf 200 was intended to replace the aging Ju-52 for the Lufthansa. She was supposed to be larger, faster and more modern than the Ju-52. The first flight took place in 1937, and in 1938 Lufthansa started using her. The Focke-Wulf 200 was the first land-based aircraft that managed to fly directly from Berlin to New York in around 24 hours. Also in 1938, she managed to fly from Berlin to Tokyo within 46 hours, although that flight included three stops. When war broke out in 1939, the Focke-Wulf 200s were confiscated and used for military purposes. Since the mid-1930s, the Luftwaffe had focused on short and mid-range combat aircraft for tactical ground support. These aircraft did very well during the fast campaigns against Poland and France. However, they were of only limited use for strategic aerial warfare. This became very apparent during the Battle of Britain in 1940, which didn't go well for Germany. Since developing a strategic bomber isn't something you can do quickly, existing aircraft had to fill this gap. Among those was the Focke-Wulf 200. The aircraft, which was called Condor, had a couple of rather useful capabilities. Among those were the large range and the long flight endurance. It made sense to use the aircraft as a long-range reconnaissance aircraft and a long-range bomber. However, it quickly became apparent that you can't militarize a civilian aircraft that easily. The way the Focke-Wulf 200 was constructed didn't allow it to be mass-produced quickly. It simply wasn't designed this way. Therefore, there were only very few Focke-Wulf 200s produced, less than 300 in total. Additionally, the weapons load was rather disappointing. She also wasn't armed or armored. The fuselage was designed for steady, calm airline flights, not for combat. This became a permanent problem, which couldn't be solved. Breaking fuselages on landings and structural damages were shockingly common. You don't have to just believe me. I have rather good witnesses. One is Eric Brown, a British test pilot, who fought against the Focke-Wulf 200 and later flew one himself. And Admiral Karl Dönitz, commander-in-chief of the submarines and later head of the German Navy. In the first phase of the war, the main problem of the submarines was actually finding convoys. There were simply not enough submarines in the North Atlantic to cover it properly. On top of that, submarines were slow and were not equipped with long-range radar. After France was occupied, there was an obvious wish for large-scale aerial reconnaissance. However, the German Navy didn't have its own fleet air arm. On pages 127 and 128, Dönitz explains why this was the case. The problem of locating convoys had to be solved. As the most natural means of naval warfare, U-boats at sea should have been provided with wide area aerial reconnaissance. The fact that U-boats, like the entire German naval force, had to fight without this capability was one of its most serious shortcomings. In contrast to this view, General Göring, from the beginning of the development of a new German air force in 1933, took the position, "Everything that flies belongs to me." The commander-in-chief of the Kriegsmarine, Grand Admiral Raeder, attempted to obtain the necessary air force from the German government in long, tough negotiations between 1933 and 39. This was unsuccessful. Cooperation between Navy and Luftwaffe was minimal. Dönitz tried using official and unofficial ways to organize aerial reconnaissance for his submarines. In some cases, he directly contacted squadron commanders in order to get them on board with this. However, his success was very limited. On page 130, Dönitz provides an insight into the desolate state of aerial reconnaissance over the Atlantic with an excerpt from his personal war diary. The entry from December 14, 1940 reads like this. Loose cooperation has so far taken place with the following units. 1. Coastal Air Group 406, Brest, which is tactically subordinate to Group West. However, its long-range BV-138 aircraft are currently grounded for 2 months due to technical defects. 2. Kampfgeschwader 40, Bordeaux. No dependency relationship whatsoever. Cooperation based on personal contact. Type Focke-Wulf 200. Currently, usually one aircraft is in operation per day. 3. Air Fleet 5. Following prior requests on a case-by-case basis, reconnaissance in a specific area has been carried out only once so far, requested again in recent days, but rejected due to lack of personnel. Dönitz pushed for his own aircraft when talking to both Admiral Raeder and Hitler. In early January 1941, Hitler agreed without talking to head of the Luftwaffe Göring. Göring tried to intervene directly, but Dönitz rebuffed him. The Kampfgeschwader 40 in Bordeaux, which used Focke-Wulf 200s, was now under control of Dönitz. Before, the Focke-Wulf 200s of that squadron had attacked convoys on their own. They were equipped with 4 250-kilogram bombs and usually dropped them at low altitude on enemy ships. They were so successful that Winston Churchill called the aircraft the Scourge of the Atlantic. However, the British overestimated the capabilities of the Condor by far. On page 11, Eric Brown writes, "The Condor was elevated to a fearsome creature by the Allies, who viewed it as a kind of winged barracuda. Its outstanding successes certainly earned it a reputation as a dangerous killer. Between August 1, 1940 and February 9, 1941, the Condors of 1st Group of Kampfgeschwader 40 sank 85 Allied ships with a total tonnage of 363,000 tons. According to Brown, the Allies guessed that the Condor was comparable to the British Lancaster bomber. They estimated a maximum bomb load of 5,000 kilograms and a fearsome defensive armament consisting of several 20mm cannons and a mix of 13mm and 7.9mm machine guns. In reality, the Focke-Wulf 200 could only carry about 1,000 kilograms of bombs due to her structural limits, and she wasn't as heavily armed as the British thought. The cruising speed was just below 300 kilometers per hour or 185 miles per hour, although her top speed was about 400 kilometers per hour or 250 miles per hour. Depending on the version, the maximum range was between 4,500 and 6,400 kilometers or between 2,800 and 4,000 miles. Service ceiling was limited to 7,350 meters. Empty weight was around 17 tons, maximum takeoff weight was around 24.5 tons. On page 191, Becker describes how the Navy missions of the Focke-Wulf 200 began. Since January 1941, four-engine Focke-Wulf 200 Condor aircraft have been flying armed reconnaissance for the U-boats. They track down convoys, attack with their four 250 kilogram bombs, the former civilian aircraft couldn't carry more, and attempt to guide U-boats by providing location information. But this new type of cooperation between the Air Force and Navy is still in its infancy. It rarely succeeds. Moreover, despite his best efforts, Lieutenant Colonel Petersen, the commander of 1st Group of Kampfgeschwader 40 in Bordeaux-Mérignac, can only keep 6 to 8 four-engine aircraft operational per day, at most. Often only a single Condor flies for the U-boats. Dönitz confirms this limited number of operational aircraft. According to him, 2 aircraft were available on average. 2 aircraft from Greenland to the Azores. You can fit entire countries into the gaps that the Focke-Wulf 200 was unable to check. And even if a convoy was found, the Focke-Wulf 200 was not able to stay long enough with it to get submarines into attack position. Due to their limited speed, submarines needed many hours to intercept convoys. By that time, the Condors had to return to base, and often the submarines didn't find the convoys. However, despite all these problems, the cooperation between the Condors and the subs was so effective that it brought the British to the brink of despair, as Brown confirms on page 25 of his book. The value of the Condor to the German war effort is easy to understand, for together with the U-boats, it virtually brought Great Britain to its knees in 1940-41. However, as a warplane, it had all the weaknesses that an aircraft originally designed as a commercial airliner must have. Its small bomb load and the fact that all its fuel lines ran along the keel of the fuselage made it extremely vulnerable. In order to react to the threat of the Condor, the Allies strengthened their convoys with freighters that were able to launch individual fighters by catapult. Later, small escort carriers that could carry 4 to 6 fighters joined the convoys as well. When fighting these interceptors, the Focke-Wulf 200 didn't do very well. Eric Brown both fought the Focke-Wulf 200 like this and flew it after the war himself. On page 24, he describes this part of the career of the Condor quite well. It was by no means an ideal aircraft for evasive maneuvers. All in all, when attacked by fighters, this aircraft had little choice but to fly straight ahead, thus providing the gunners with a stable platform to engage the attacker. Brown describes an engagement during which an F4F Martlet, which was called Wildcat in the US, rammed a Focke-Wulf 200. While the F4F survived badly damaged, the fragile Focke-Wulf 200 was completely destroyed. Since the Luftwaffe couldn't take losses due to the already low number of Focke-Wulf 200s available, the Condor switched from attacks to reconnaissance. Brown describes this change on page 11. In the late summer of 1941, Fliegerführer Atlantik radically changed the Condor's mission from being a fighter against supply ships to being a teammate of the U-boats. The crews were instructed to no longer conduct attacks independently and, in the event of a fighter attack, to seek the cover of cloud banks. Fighting was to be undertaken only if evasive action was not possible. A powerful asset for the reconnaissance role was the air-to-ground radar FUG-200 Hohenthiel, which was installed aboard the Condors. It had a maximum range of 150 kilometers and dramatically increased the area a Condor could cover. The ongoing usage as a combat aircraft came at a price, though. The fragile aircraft had, as said before, a number of structural weaknesses within the fuselage, which started to become fatal. Eric Brown describes them on page 17. The airframe's weakness was the result of the rapid conversion of a commercial airliner to the needs of a combat aircraft. In fact, no changes were made to the airframe with the Condor's new mission in mind. An airframe designed only for everyday scheduled service at medium altitudes could hardly meet the continuous, rigorous demands of operational low-level flight over long periods, often coupled with harsh evasive maneuvers. Thus, there were numerous fractures in the rear fuselage during landing. Despite improvements in the Focke-Wulf 200 C3 version through airframe reinforcement at this critical point. The Focke-Wulf 200 was also used as a cargo transporter and a personal transport for the Nazi leadership. Adolf Hitler, SS head Heinrich Himmler, Foreign Affairs Minister von Ribbentrop, Minister of Armaments Speer, head of the Luftwaffe Göring, and Admiral Dönitz himself had personal Focke-Wulf 200 aircraft. She was used as a cargo transporter during the Stalingrad drama. However, there the Luftwaffe lost several of them. The Soviets captured them and used them for their own purposes. From 1943 onward, the Focke-Wulf 200 was basically only used as a transport aircraft. Bombing and reconnaissance missions became too dangerous and were taken over by other aircraft, like the Ju-290 or the Heinkel HE-177. As a civilian airliner, the Focke-Wulf 200 wasn't just used by the German Lufthansa, but also by airlines in Brazil, Denmark, and Great Britain. The Luftwaffe never exported the militarized version of the Focke-Wulf 200, although Japan was interested in such a variant before the outbreak of the war. The British were able to study an interned model before it was destroyed in 1941. As said before, the Soviets used a few captured models well into the post-war era. Some Focke-Wulf 200s that crash-landed in Spain were used by the Spanish Air Force until they ran out of spare parts. According to Wikipedia, this happened around 1950. Focke-Wulf 200s that crash-landed in Portugal were not used by the Portuguese Air Force. Today, there's only one complete model of the Focke-Wulf 200 left.
Finishing words.
Despite her weaknesses and her limited numbers, the Focke-Wulf 200 was, for a short while, from autumn 1940 to summer 1941, a significant weapon in the fight between Germany and Great Britain. However, the British adapted fairly quickly to the Condor threat. They were lucky that due to wrong pre-war planning and the lack of coordination between Navy and Luftwaffe, the Germans acted fairly ineffective here. Had the Luftwaffe focused on the Ju-89 and the Do-19, as the Americans had focused on the B-17 and the British had on the short Stirling, the submarine war of 1940 and 41 could have been a lot more dramatic for Britain. In the end, the Focke-Wulf 200 couldn't fulfill the role it was used for. She did her best, but she was never able to fully outgrow her true nature of a civilian airliner.
Thank you for your interest.